I'd like to introduce today's presenter, Jeff Gray. Jeff, you now have the floor.
Thanks, Rob, and good morning, everybody. I'm Jeff Gray. I'm VP of Business Operations at CoreOS. This is my colleague, Joe Thompson, who's a systems engineer. I'm going to take you through a little bit of high level of what we're going to do today, why it might matter to you, what we're going to see. Then Joe's going to run through a demo for how to configure a CoreOS cluster. Joe is an engineer and knows this stuff really deeply. I'm not, and I don't, so I'm going to play the role of dumb question guy, just in case there's anything, just in case you guys are too shy to ask yours, I'll ask them on your behalf. But please do put questions in. And thanks again to Microsoft for having us here, and thank you for joining us. So who is CoreOS? So CoreOS is building tools to run the world's container. We're building tools for modern infrastructure. We're an open source company. We have a bunch of open source projects. CoreOS Linux is the one that we'll be focusing on today, but you can see some of our other ones on this slide. We also have commercial products, Tectonic, which is our entire stack, which I'll get into in a second, and Quay, our container registry. A little bit more company boilerplate. We're a startup. We're a Series B startup. You can see some of our investors and our team here. Our open source users are from companies or universities or individuals all over the world in all kinds of functions and tasks. From a commercial perspective, our tools are for the enterprise. They're for people running serious web workloads, expecting serious scale, trying to manage complexity. That's really our target and who we want to use the stuff that we're going to show you today. One more boilerplate slide before I get into some content. You can see some of the customers we're proud to be able to talk about and some of our partners. Again, thank you to Microsoft and Azure for having us here today. We are excited to do this, and I think having worked with a bunch of partners across the industry, I'm really impressed with what Azure's doing, both in terms of the product itself, the technical capabilities, and then also the customer focus of the organization. I think it's unique among their competitors for that, and so there's a lot there. Okay, so what is this stuff, this container stuff, this modern infrastructure stuff that we're talking about? What are we doing here with this stuff? So this is what the world used to look like. And for some of you and some of your companies, it may still look like this. And by the way, I don't judge you if that's the case. If it looks like this, that means you've built something up, you've invested a lot in it, it's made you successful, and you're running. You have that investment there. So I don't judge you if you're not running the latest cutting, bleeding edge stuff at all. But the sort of traditional data center is purpose-built. It's monolithic architectures. You had an ERP, and you built up a stack and a team around that, and that runs a certain way. You built a big data app, and you built up a stack and a team around that, and you run that a certain way. This means you don't get the same resource utilization you could because you aren't able to share across. And this means you have specialized silos of knowledge, people who know how this thing runs over here, that makes life very fragile and brittle to change. So, of course, there's a different way of doing stuff, and that different way is brought to life by the hyperscale companies, by the Googles and the Amazons and the Microsofts. Google has done a lot of work to sort of increase this space by publishing a bunch of research papers. This is a picture of Borg, of their research paper about their infrastructure system. But it's a different way. It's a different way of modeling things. It's a different way. If you're running a system the scale of Azure, or if you're running a system the scale of Gmail, how do you do that? And how do you do that well? And how do you manage the complexity of that? You may not be running a system the scale of Azure in your company today, but increasingly, no matter what industry you're in, your business is more and more digital. You have more online. More of your business matters online. And you're competing with the hyperscale internet companies in whatever business you're in. If you're in automotive, you're competing with Google. If you're in payments, you're competing with Facebook. They run their infrastructure in a different way that lets them be more flexible. It lets them move more quickly. It lets them work at a higher level of abstraction. Tools exist where you can now do that too, and CoreOS is helping to lead the charge there. So why does this stuff matter to you? What's the value prop here? It might matter for a few reasons. The first is you're moving to cloud. Some companies are in all different stages of that journey, be it public cloud like Azure or private cloud. Containerization is actually a great way to start. You can containerize up your apps. You can get them running in the environment they're in. That helps make them portable and consistent and prepare for your move to cloud. You might care about this tech because you want consistency in your environments. Maybe you're already in a hybrid environment where, because of legacy or because of acquisitions, you're running in multiple environments, public or private. Or you just want consistency between development and test and production. Containers and the CoreOS infrastructure can help you get a consistency of operating model so you know what's going on across all of your diverse environments. You might want to do this because you run at big scale. Again, you may not be Google, but maybe you're growing quickly. The cost of running on specialized large hardware is too much. You want to run on commodity hardware. You want to run wherever the compute is the cheapest and fastest and meets your security policies. This technology helps you do that. Or maybe you're here because you're exploring containers. Your company has a container strategy or has tasked you to build one. Many, many enterprises all over the world are exploring this trend. And what we're going to explore today here is some of the most secure and best of breed tech in that space. Okay, so when I say tech, what do I mean? The tech that we're going to be talking about today. So this is sort of the whole CoreOS stack. It is packaged up in a product called Tectonic that's available for purchase. You can go to our website and get it at tectonic.com. And here's all the components. What we're going to focus on today is CoreOS Linux, which is available in the Azure Marketplace right now. It's open source. You can download it and start using it for free. If I make the analogy between a smartphone and this stack, what Joe's going to show you today with CoreOS Linux, it's sort of like booting up your iPhone and manually configuring a dialer. It's good for learning what's going on with the phone, but it's not full use. You need a stack like this. You need a stack like Tectonic to fully run in production and fully get the benefit from this. But we thought it was worth going through that sort of process of booting up the phone and starting the dialer because there is a lot going on in the container space. There are vendors and tools, and they interoperate with each other in confusing and unspecified ways. The way for you to make a good decision about what you're doing is to understand the technology, and CoreOS Linux is fundamental to that, and the layers above it. And we wanted to start by showing you what you can get started there in the marketplace today, and have you a little bit of understanding of how this technology works, so that when you go, to go to the equivalent of your iTunes store or your Google Play store, you understand what you're doing, and you're making a good decision for your company. So a little bit more on benefits for Tectonic and for CoreOS. You can see them here. You can move faster. Your apps can be portable. You can pack things tighter on your servers and have higher utilization. And the way we think about security and some features that are unique to CoreOS and CoreOS's stack, security can be built in, security can be automated. So I'm going to move from talking about this kind of whole space and containers in general to speaking a little bit more about CoreOS Linux and what we're going to do for the rest of the session today, although we're happy to take questions on any of it as we go. So what is CoreOS Linux? It is a Linux operating system. It's the first sort of micro OS. It created the category. It is built for distributed systems. It is made for that, and there's some assumptions there that are really important about what you can do with that I'll get to in a second. It's purpose-built to run stuff in containers, and it updates itself. And that's all it does. It is simpler than most OSs that you're used to in a way I can show here. So most operating systems, most distributions, they look something like this. They have a bunch of stuff in it. They have the kernel, and they have an init system like systemd, and then they have a bunch of other tools that you need and runtimes that you need to run your applications. And every time you do anything, you get all of this. CoreOS is different. All you get in CoreOS is the bare minimums you need to, again, to run an application in container. What you do then is you package up your application with all the dependencies it needs, and you can run it there. Joe's going to show a little bit of what this looks like later. But it's a fundamentally different way of thinking about how to architect your infrastructure. And it lets you do a couple things that I'll get to in a moment. So this isn't a science project. We have big customers running large workloads in production today, running billions of dollars of value through this software. One customer that we're really proud to be able to talk about is called the International Securities Exchange. They were a publicly traded exchange. They're in negotiations to be purchased by NASDAQ for $1 billion. And they run their exchange, they run their core exchange on CoreOS. So they run it in a hybrid environment. They have some data centers where they run CoreOS, and then they're migrating some of that workload to public cloud, as I'm sure many of you are considering doing. And you can see some of the performance numbers here. They're in billions of transactions a day, and billions of dollars flow through the system in a secure and reliable manner. So I'm going to move a little bit to talk about automatic updates, which is one of the key features of this and one of the things Joe will demonstrate in a minute. So this is a solved problem on the browser in your laptop. Your browser, be it Explorer or Chrome or whatever, it updates itself. And therefore, you know that you have the latest and most secure version. This traditionally has not been the case with server infrastructure. Server infrastructure has been, it's been really hard to get going. It's been brittle to configure. And once you get it running, you set it and forget it and try not to touch it again. And there's a problem there. And the problem there is that vulnerabilities happen. They happen in our code. They happen in your code. They happen in the Linux kernel code. They happen all the time. It's a fallacy to say that we can prevent them, that we can make vulnerabilities never happen. But what we can do is make updates easy to get. We can make updates low risk. And we can make sure that you're always running the most current. Here's a quote that I won't read to you from Greg Crowell-Hartman, who's the Linux Kerbal Stable Maintainer at our conference a couple of months ago. He's fixing 10 bugs in the kernel every day. And as he says, they're not all security issues, but we're not actually sure what's going to end up being a security issue down the road. You and your company simply can't keep up to date with this. So one way to think about CoreOS is that it's a kernel as a service. It's a service that's providing you an always up-to-date and therefore the most secure, most fully featured, most performant Linux kernel. So how do we do this? We do it through an automatic update scheme. I mentioned this was built for distributed systems. So imagine a system where you're running your application on many hosts. It's okay and expected to take them down at unpredictable times for maintenance, and you don't suffer any performance. And imagine updates can happen automatically without you worrying about them. And that's what we do. Really simply, and Joe's actually going to demonstrate in a minute a little bit of how this works. What happens is that CoreOS is architected with two partitions, with an A and a B. When an update is available, we download that update, either from the internet or from an update server that you run yourself, onto the partition that's not in use. We bring that machine down at a time when it's safe to do so, and we bring it up on the other partition with the new update. And again, Joe's going to show how this can work for you in a moment. It might be a little scary if you're thinking about running stuff in production. It might be a little scary to think, my stuff's just going to go down all the time without control. You can just let the software do it for you, or you can configure and manage how you do that. We have an update system that is extensible and customizable, so you can do it based on your business rules, your security rules, whatever you're comfortable with. And here's a screenshot of an application that we call Core Update that lets you manage it. The graph with the pink line in the middle shows how many of each, in this data center, how many of each of the host in production is on which version. At the right, you can see our alpha, beta, and stable channels. If you go in the marketplace, you'll see those three channels. If you go in the Azure marketplace, you'll see those three channels for CoreOS. And you can run all through those, and we'll get to in a little bit what that means. So what else does CoreOS do for you? It incorporates SE Linux, so you have fine-grained access controls. You can manage your users and manage access to your systems and your data. It's performant. In part, it's performant because there's less software. It's a simpler tool that takes less resources to get running and to run. The last thing I want to call out about CoreOS itself is that we'll help you out. Enterprise support is available for purchase from us. We have 24/7/365 coverage with an hour response time. Again, if you're an international security exchange and you're running in production, you want a company to stand behind the software that they build, and we will do that for you. So I'm going to wrap up and turn it over to Joe, who's going to run through these scenarios for you guys today. Again, what I want you to remember is that we're introducing a new way of thinking about computing, a new way of thinking about computing on the server side that's based on distributed systems, that's based on containerized applications, and those two things allow us to do automatic updates that are more secure. So again, we're going to do the how to turn on the iPhone and sort of get a dialer going. There's a lot more there, and we'll get to it at the very end where you can go to check out resources and next steps. But we think it's important that you understand what this tech is and how you might use it so that you know what you're doing and as you navigate this crazy, overhyped container and cloud landscape. So Joe, if you guys were here for the onboarding call, you provisioned a CoreOS cluster from the Azure Marketplace. If you missed that and you don't have a cluster up and running, the instructions are there and the link posted and I think pinned to the top of the Q&A. So we're going to start from there. We're going to show you how to run an update. I'm going to show you how to run an etcd cluster, which is necessary to understand the cluster of machines and maintain the state. I'm going to show you how to get those containers on the network so they can talk to each other and to the outside world as it may be. And then we're going to run a simplified container application. So Joe, I'll turn it over to you to actually go through it. And like I said, I'll feed questions from the group as we go. So over
okay.
to you.
Sounds great. I'm going to apologize in advance. If I go too fast, somebody I assume will tell me, hey, whoa, slow down. I'll go ahead and start this going while I start talking about other things. So the first thing I want to do is just do a quick recap of what did we do during the deployment. And what we did during the deployment was we set up two things. We set up an etcd cluster, and you're going to see my speaker notes here that I've been working on. So.
And just to be clear, those speaker notes are the exact same thing that's in the link that I mentioned.
Right.
I think Joe's just got it in that spreadsheet so he can easily copy and paste it. You don't have to watch and highlight stuff. But it's the exact same notes that are in the GitHub link that we shared in the chat.
It's for copying and pasting, also because I have an awful memory for things. And so there are important things that I want to make sure that I talk about, and that's the only way. So when we did the provisioning lab about a week and a half ago, we provisioned three etcd peers in a cluster, and we provisioned two container hosts that are not members of the cluster but are connected to it through what's called an etcd proxy. So what is etcd? In five words, etcd is a distributed key value store. That's it. It is only that. And that's a very simple thing but also a very powerful thing. I've had people, when I go out and do training, they think that etcd is like some kind of, because it has etcd in the name, they think it's some kind of magical configuration system that will configure all the hosts in your environment. And it's not that. But you can use it for that. You can use it as a building block to that.
I think this is one of the sort of hard problems in computer science that Joe's minimizing a little bit. I mentioned it's distributed systems. We have a cluster of machines. How do you know what state they're in? How do you know that machine A is current and machine B is not? And etcd solves that problem for you in a way that's fairly simple to maintain.
What etcd is particularly good for is two things. Number one is allowing hosts to decide on something, who's going to run a thing or what the current value of a setting is. The other thing is to have a source of truth, to be able to look at the etcd key value store and know what the status of things in the cluster or in the environment is.
Cool. Let's get going.
All right. So let's jump right in. I have already logged into my two container hosts. So I'm going to start by showing you a few things that may not look like they make any particular sense right now, but you're going to see how they do make sense as soon as we look at the update method. The first thing is, let's look at how our file systems are mounted on this host. Now you can see we've got a root file system, a user file system, a couple of others, fairly standard. But what I want to draw your attention to is the user file system is mounted read-only. And that's important because that's one of the ways that we keep the security in CoreOS pretty tight. Is it's very difficult for somebody to break into a CoreOS system and then modify things on that file system with that read-only mount. And that also enables us to do our atomic updates in a secure manner, which is what we're going to see in just a second. The other thing I want to show you is a couple of attributes about the disk.
And so if you're following along with the script, you're in that first exercise, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So the first thing is we don't use the old MBR format for the disk. We use the newer GPT format. And the reason we do that is because that allows us to not only specify like a start and end and a type for each partition, but it also allows us to assign metadata to a partition. So what we have here is these two partitions called USRA and USRB. At any given time, one of them is mounted as the user partition and the other one is not mounted and is available for updates. So they each have metadata. This is a brand new system, so when we look at the metadata here, we see this is USRA. We have booted successfully off it, and it has a priority of 1. This USRB has not been used at all. So it has priority 0. It's never been booted off of. It's never been successfully booted off of. It's a blank slate as far as we're concerned right now. The other thing is, as most distributions do these days, we have the OS release file, which will tell you explicitly, if your system banner didn't, what version you're running. So we see here we're running a relatively old version of CoreOS. It's not that old. It's maybe about a week or two old. This is CoreOS stable 899.17.0. Well, the current stable is version 10 something dot something. So let's go ahead and kick off that update. So we initiate the update check. Now we can watch the status happen. And what it's going to do here, it's already detected there's an update available. It's just waiting to start downloading that update. And when it does start downloading that update, we'll see this progress counter here start to increment. Now, while we're waiting for that to happen, I'm going to kick off the update on my other host as well so that we have corresponding versions on both of them. And we see this also has detected its update, and we're waiting for it to start downloading now.
So I just went on and on about automatic updates, and you're doing a manual update. How do I reconcile that I was talking about automatic and you had to kick this off manually?
So the reason that I kick it off manually is, number one, so that I can show what the updates look like, how they progress. The other thing is because by default, a CoreOS system will ping whatever update host it's using every 45 minutes to see if there's an update. Well, that's what it does automatically. In the event that you had some kind of critical vulnerability happen and you wanted to update them manually right now without waiting, this is how you would do it. You would go in and do an update engine client, check for update, and then you could monitor the status.
So normally you would wait for this to happen either by how we have it configured by default or how you configure it yourself. We're, for the purposes of this demo, we're pretending we have an urgent reason to do it right now. And let's go in and do it right now.
Exactly.
Got it.
And, you know, it's somewhat illustrative to show what the status change is as we go through the process, because it'll actually show you that it's downloading, and then after it's downloading that it's verifying, and then that it's finalizing, and then it finally will tell you reboot needed. So what it is actually doing right now, I mentioned that it's going out and pinging the update server, and there's a little bit of a process around that. So the first thing is it goes to the update server, in this case the public core update server that we run, and it says, is there a newer version than the one I have? Well, in this case, the core update server came back and said, yes, there is. There's a newer version of 10.10 or 10.15 or whatever the version number is. Then it's waiting. It's kind of throttled a little bit, so it's waiting to begin that download. It will download that update as one single binary blob, and that is a signed binary. So what it can do, there's keys embedded in the CoreOS distribution. So it can use the keys that it already knows to verify the signature on that update and verify that that update hasn't been tampered with. That update is also transmitted through TLS secured connection so that it can't be tampered with in flight. And now we actually see it's downloading. It's about 90%, or no, excuse me, it's about 10% done. This actually counts up from 0.0 to 1.0. So we're moving right along. So it downloads the update, it verifies it, it applies it to the partition that's not currently mounted as user. So we call that the passive partition. In this case, that would be partition number 4 on this host. After that update is applied, but before the host has rebooted, it will update the metadata. So it will actually change the priority of that partition. When it reboots, there's a custom grub module that fires off at the very beginning of the boot process and looks at the partition metadata, and every time it boots, that grub module makes a decision which partition it's going to try to boot from. Now, because it's going to have a higher priority than the one that it booted from last time on partition 4, now it's going to prefer to boot off that partition that just got updated. So it'll attempt to boot. If the boot is successful, then about a minute or so after it's successfully booted, it will update the metadata to say successful equals 1. That's what we saw on our partition 3. If it's not successful, there's a watchdog that fires off and forcibly reboots the host. It will try another couple of times to boot off that update partition because maybe something else interfered. Maybe the update was fine, but something else kept the host from booting and we don't know what. So we'll try a couple of times, and then when it's tried 3 times and failed to boot all 3 times, then it will stop trying. It will mark that partition as bad, and it will leave it alone until the next update happens, and then it will start trying all over again.
There's a question. Well, that's getting close to 80% done. There's a question from someone who was on the onboarding call with us that they need some help with how to run SSH commands, and what interface do they use to run SSH and sudo commands?
What interface? If you're on Windows, there should be instructions in there for using PuTTY, for downloading and configuring and using PuTTY for SSH. If you're on OS X, you should have an SSH client already on your system. which is you'll pull up a terminal app and then you can use the command line SSH client. And if you're on Linux, you definitely have a command line SSH client. You pull up a terminal there and you can walk through generating the key and using the key to log into these hosts.
Got it. Thanks. So if you're stuck on Mac, go to the terminal. On Windows, go to CMD, and this stuff should be in the instructions that we put in the chat.
Now, these are both finalizing, so do we have any other questions while this is chunking away?
There is another one. It says you guys mentioned, and we did, the alpha, beta, and stable channels, and you can see those in the marketplace. What are those? What's the difference? What are those for? Why do we have three of them?
Why we have three is if you've done software development, the traditional development model usually has dev and then some kind of test, and then you're actually running in production. Or sometimes there might be dev and then unit test and then integration test in production, or whatever the case may be. But there's a concept of moving it from it's very raw and it's still changing rapidly up to, all right, this stuff is pretty solid. We're actually ready to put this in production and run it for real. And that's kind of what our alpha, beta, and stable channels are. The alpha channel is released early, released often. We put the latest versions of things in there. That's going to have a really recent version of the kernel, a really recent version of systemd, a really new version of Docker, and we release that pretty aggressively. That's for people to be able to preview new features. There are certain things that we used to recommend running that in production, but mainly what that's for is so that people can see what's coming down the pipe and get ready for changes in etcd or changes in CoreOS Linux that may affect what they're doing. All right, so this says it needs a reboot, so I'm going to...
Why does it need a reboot?
It needs a reboot because the update has been verified and applied, and now it wants to reboot to actually implement that update. Before I reboot that host, and I'll get back to the channels in just a second, I want to show you, if we repeat that command where we look at... Now we can see here... This partition 4 that the update was applied to says priority 2 tries 1. Now it hasn't actually been tried yet, but it's writing that metadata before it tries it so that if the boot isn't successful, it still has a counter there to know how many times it's tried. So now I'm going to reboot that, and then I'll finish discussing.
And so again, if this was just running in Azure or in your data center, this would all be automatic, but this is just because we've forced it for the purpose of this lab.
Yes, exactly. And, one of the things is I tell people you want to get to that vision of the world where you no longer really have to. You might still do it for your own paranoia. You no longer have to keep track of every single host reboot and every single rack because they reboot themselves and they come back by themselves and your app stays up the whole time because your app is written to deal with a single host going down. It's written to be resilient. So we talked about the alpha channel while they're rebooting. The beta channel is it's a little more stable than the alpha channel. We recommend people go ahead and run some of those in production, kind of what's called a canary deployment. And the reason for that is that gives you some early warning of, okay, we need to put this into production to really see how it runs and see if it's going to break things. Hopefully not, but if it does, you can come back to us and say, hey, we were running, beta version whatever with our app, and it broke, and we think that's a problem with the distribution. Right. Here's
it might break because there's a new version of Docker.
Right.
It might break because something with your custom hardware drivers changed. And so having a few beta hosts mixed in there lets you know that before you do a big bang rollout of stable, which would be about once a month.
Right. And the stable channel, of course, as it is with pretty much all software, is we think that's pretty ironclad. It's production ready. Please do run it. It's, enterprise supported. Now, one of the other things, one of the side effects of doing it the way we do it with the aggressive alpha and beta releases and kind of, throttling back on the stable is if there is a serious bug or a security vulnerability that leaks out, it will usually be detected and contained in alpha and beta. We actually had that happen recently. We have a blog post up about it. We released an alpha version that had a security vulnerability. Somebody actually figured it out within a couple hours, reported it back to us, and in the middle of the night on a weekend, within some fairly low time.
It was 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. on a Sunday night. It was perfect timing.
Yeah. We had, 99% of the hosts updated within 5 hours?
That's correct.
And that was because we release that alpha aggressively. And the other side effect of the alpha-beta stable system was anybody who was running on stable wasn't affected, because it was the alpha people who know what they're getting into, kind of. They know the chance they're taking. And they found that vulnerability before it got as far as beta or stable. So that's another nice side effect of doing it the way we do it. So now we've got both our hosts back, and we're logged in, and we see that we're now running CoreOS stable 10.10.5.0, which is the current stable. Unless we release another one later today, then it'll be, you know, 10.10 something else.
Thursdays.
Yeah, man.
Not today.
So, and again, if we do that CGPT show, we now see that we have a successful equals one. The tries count has been reinitialized to zero. It's still priority two, and it will stay priority two until another update comes down and is applied to partition three, and then this priority will be bumped up to three. And so the cycle repeats with every update. Not going to do the OS release because it's just going to be repeating what we already saw. One of the other interesting things is we mentioned that, you know, we make it possible for you to not have all your hosts reboot at once. And the way we do that is if the update manager on the host has access to an etcd cluster, it will actually by default try to set a lock. And we can see that right here. And it will say, before it reboots, it will say, hey guys, I'm rebooting. Nobody else reboot while I'm out. And then when it comes back, it will clear that lock. And so what we see is this lock is currently not being held by anyone. So if we had multiple hosts contending for a reboot window, somebody else could come in and grab that lock now and reboot.
So this is how I make sure all the hosts in my cluster don't all go down at the same time for an update, or how it guarantees that for me.
And you can actually, you have some degree of control over hosts being, you can have groups of hosts that are allowed to update independently of other groups of hosts. So, you know, if one app has five hosts and the other app has five hosts, you don't have to wait for them to go one at a time until all 10 have gone. You can let one go in this group and one go in that group at the same time. Okay. So, you know, and we don't really go into a lot of that in this lab, but there's a lot of documentation on that on our website. The things that you want to look for are Locksmith and Update Engine, if you want to go look at that.
Cool. So now we're moving to the second exercise about working with etcd, right?
Yes, exactly. So the first thing for working with etcd is let's check our cluster health. And indeed, the cluster is healthy. What the etcd client has done is gone out to each host and checked its health status.
What does healthy mean? Why would I get something that's not healthy?
If it's not healthy, that means that etcd is not listening, or etcd is running in a marginal status for some reason. It may decide that that member itself is not healthy because it can't get its heartbeats out on time or something like that.
So I might have a hardware problem, or I might have a network problem or something else.
Right. So you have individual hosts that can report their own health status, and if all your individual members, your peers, if you will, are healthy, then your cluster is healthy. Now, in this case, we have a three-member cluster. We saw that in the cluster health, and now we see it again when we list the members. Now, in every etcd cluster, there is one leader. If the leader goes down or there's a network split or something like that, a new leader will be elected. Right now, the leader on my cluster is this 10.0.0.5 peer. So what I can do is I will look at a follower first. So Jeff, pick a number, 4 or 6?
6.
Okay. So let's look at 10.0.0.6. And we'll ask it to give us its stats on itself. And this little JQ dot at the end, that's just a little utility for querying JSON. And if you give it dot as the query filter, it just pretty prints it. It doesn't parse it or filter it at all. So what we have here is these are all the stats on this follower. Now, if I ask that same follower to give me stats on the leader, what it will do is say, I am not the current leader, so I don't know the leader stats. So we know that the leader is number 5, and if we ask number 5 for the leader stats, then we get a whole lot of statistics. And so the point here is just that you have this API available in etcd to get all kinds of stats on your cluster, on the members of your cluster, on how things are running. And there's a lot more to it than what I just demonstrated. I would highly recommend that you read the documentation for the etcd API if you want to develop things that can use etcd as a source of truth or a source of resolving contention.
I need to know a lot about etcd if I'm trying to build some tooling for distributed systems, if I'm trying to build Kubernetes or something. If I'm trying to run a cluster and run my web app, do I need to know the details of the etcd interface?
You probably don't, unless you're building something that is actually going to use as part of the application etcd. But if your application is just built on top of a layer that uses etcd, like our distributed application is going to be WordPress running inside containers on the Flannel network. So Flannel depends on etcd, but WordPress doesn't know about etcd at all.
Got it.
And that's fine.
Got it.
So the one thing that we do here, we just for reiterating so that we have it so that we can look at, is we do that recursive list of the entire etcd key value store again. And now let's go ahead and set a key. So I just set slash foo to my name. Now if I go over to my other host and I go etcd control get foo, I see my name there. So simple as it is, this is just demonstrating that we can...
Distributed systems.
Distributed systems. We can set a value on one host and we can read that value on another host. Let's see. Now what you can do with etcd is you can actually watch a key. So now I have this sitting there waiting for any change, and if I set that key instead of Joe, I set it to Alex. Now that watch returns with the changed updated value. Now let me remove that key, because the next one is you can watch not only a single key, you can watch an entire tree. So I can do dash dash recursive foo. Now over here, I can set foo bar to...
Oh, I do have a typo. Okay,
well,
spelled wrong.
It probably wouldn't matter, but yeah. So I can set foo bar to Jeff. Now notice it returned with a little more info, because now I'm watching a whole subtree, so I don't know by default which key changed unless it tells me. And so it does tell me that the key foo bar was set, and it tells me that it was set to Jeff. One other nifty trick that you can do, feel free to use this in whatever clever way you can come up with, is you can actually set a recursive watch. You can set an exec watch. And when that comes back, it gives you the value that was changed. And so over here, I can say set foobaz to Alex. And over here, it says hello, Alex, because what it did is it actually executed this echo command with the variable that returned from the etcd watch. So one thing you'll notice here is this does not return. By default, exec watches do not return back to a command prompt. They run forever, unless you tell them not to. Other watches don't run forever by default, but can be told to with the dash dash forever flag.
So this is important. Yeah. Is this important because you're demonstrating how these distributed systems communicate with one another and maintain state? You're demonstrating the sort of functions they do, but you're
yes,
just with simple
exactly.
name setting?
It's twofold. It's that, and it's also, there may be situations where, you know, something gets really, really, you know, out of whack in your environment, and part of the process of fixing it may be going in and watching things in etcd to say, okay, what's setting this key? Or, okay, we need to fix this key because it's set wrong. And so it's important to have at least a basic overview of how you can monitor things in the etcd store and how you can fix things in the etcd store.
Got it. But so we're basically just building this layer cake from the bottom up.
Right.
First, we provisioned the host from the marketplace before we got on this lab. Mm-hmm. Now you've got etcd set up so they are talking to one another and they are a distributed system. And now we're going to go help them get on the network with Flannel with the third exercise.
Now, when we talk about networking, by default, there is, of course, the host networking. We see here we have a private IP. We also have a public IP, but we don't see it because in Azure it's a NAT tunnel of some type. So the important thing here, though, is we have this host interface 10.0.1.4. If I run a container...
And will theirs be 10.0.1.4 or will it be something else?
It may be something else. It should be, if you use the deployment template, it should be 10.0.1-something. It's probably 10.0.1, some low number. So if I run this here, if I run a container, and I'm running a BusyBox container, and if you're not familiar with BusyBox, BusyBox is basically just a tiny little shell that has all kinds of nifty tools integrated into it. And so Docker is starting up, and it's going to do a Docker pull for BusyBox. I'll go ahead and run that here too.
Network calls.
Yeah.
In a demo.
You know, this worked 6 times in a row, the last 6 times
what's,
I did this.
What's in BusyBox while we're waiting for it to download?
BusyBox has lots and lots of little tools integrated into it. So it's got Netcat, it's got Ping, it's got NSLookup. It does not have Dig. That's one thing that's kind of unfortunate. But it does have NSLookup, so you can do host lookups with it. You have all kinds of options.
So you're doing this because like I said at the beginning, Chorus is so simple, it doesn't come with much.
Yeah.
If you want to do some manual debugging and manual configuration like we're doing, you need to install some of those utilities in a container.
Yeah.
Is that effectively the purpose?
Yeah, you're going to need to put a container into the scope of some container that you're debugging or, you know, whatever the case may be. It's useful to know about BusyBox because it just gives you kind of a Swiss Army knife shell that you can use to do this stuff with.
Kill that and try it again?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe, I don't know what's going on with my Docker. You get to see some...
Live debugging.
Live debugging. Let's see. Actually, I want journal control. Journal ctl-udocker.service. Let's see. Oops. Okay, let's do that again. This time hit the right key. Okay, it just took a long time for some reason.
But it's there.
It's there on the other host. I'm just going to let this one run. And in the meantime, I'll do it over here.
You got it on that one.
Yeah. Okay, so we're inside a container now. So this is actually BusyBox inside of a container. I can do an IPA, and I see I have this here, this address, is actually from something called the Docker Bridge. And that's the default networking method that Docker uses. So if I exit out of the container, I will actually see, I didn't have this before now, and I have it now because Docker started up. So I have this Docker Zero Bridge, it's configured, that's the same subnet that I used, or that I saw inside the container. Okay, this one's firing off now too, great. The other thing I can do inside that container is, Docker run. Oh, yeah, okay. 1 sec while I reestablish my flow. Okay. So I can see, the IP, this is 172.17.02. Now, on the host, there's a couple things that I want to show you. The Docker Zero Bridge is host local only. So containers can talk to each other within a host, but how would traffic get off that host? We look at the routing, and we see that that entire subnet is directed to the Docker Zero interface. And since we know that's a bridge, we can use the brctl command to see what interfaces are connected to that bridge. And we see here there are no interfaces connected to it. So there is no way for traffic to leave that host right now from a Docker container unless you were to do some very tedious port forwarding or tunneling or something of that nature. And that's going to be a very brittle solution if you were to do it that
way. So pause for me here as the non-technical guy. So
okay.
For normal networks, as I understand it, each host gets an IP address and gets on the network and can communicate that way.
Right.
Now we have several, maybe, applications running in containers or components of applications or microservices or whatever it may be, they're on a single host, right? And
right.
So what you're talking about, I think, is how do we get those applications on the network as if they were sort of full members who need to communicate within each other and without, right? Is that effectively what we're doing?
And it's not only how do we get them on the network, but how do we get them on the network without having to do a whole lot of tedious, brittle, very detailed manual work to get that connection between containers and between containers and the broader network established.
Right.
So fortunately for us,
and so if we were running on, sort of one giant server and had everything packed on there, we wouldn't have to manage this complexity, right? But because we've got these containers, we've got multiple hosts, we've got distributed systems. A problem like how do they get on the network and how do we route traffic between them? becomes a complicated problem. And so you're showing this tool called Flannel,
right,
which manages that complicated problem for you, right?
Right. And part of the reason it's so complicated is, by default, one of the nice things about containers is that they are isolated from each other and from host networking. But that's not always what you want. You don't want complete isolation, because while it may be very secure that way, it's also not very useful. So what we do is, there's two components to setting up Flannel. One is actually setting up the configuration for it in the etcd cluster. And so what we're going to do is set this key with the network info we're going to use for Flannel. Now I'm going to use this 10.2.0.0/16 network. You can pick any network number you want, as long as it's good practice for it not to conflict with existing networks that your hosts have to access. Because then you're going to have contention between, oh, is this supposed to be a Flannel IP in the container, or is it a real network somewhere on my network? Now, the other thing we're doing here is setting up what's called a systemd drop-in. And that's a little snippet of configuration for an existing, what's called a unit file that runs a service. And in this case, what we're going to do is tell the Docker unit, you don't use your standalone networking anymore. You depend on Flannel. So to do that, we just add this little snippet to our drop-in. And then we go back to our workflow here, and we do a daemon reload, which tells systemd itself, go back and look at all the config files because I made changes. Then we also do a restart of Docker, because right now the Docker daemon is already up and it's using its own networking, and we want to take it down and bring it back. And if you notice that little pause there, that's where Flannel was starting up before Docker started up, because we now declared that it depends on Flannel. So now if I look at my host network, two things. Number one, Docker 0 no longer uses that 172 network. It's using our Flannel networking. The other thing is, we have a new interface called Flannel 0 that has, it's actually part of that broad, that entire Flannel, what's called the allocation network. Now, if you notice here, this one is using a smaller subnet of that allocation network. And that's how Flannel works. There's a broad allocation network, and hosts check in with etcd, essentially, and allocate themselves a subnet out of it. So we can actually see that if we do a recursive ls of the etcd again. This right here is what just happened. Flannel checked in. It created this key. And if I do an etcd ctl get on that key, now it says public IP for this host is 10.0.1.4. It's not really the public IP, but as far as Flannel is concerned, it is. That's the interface Flannel is going to talk on to other hosts. So now we can go over. I'm just going to very quickly do this on the other host without narrating it so much, because we're doing the exact same thing we just did. And need to insert that. Do the daemon reload.
So while you're doing that, just to sort of landmark where we are, right? So before we started here, we went into the Azure Marketplace and we configured and provisioned a bunch of hosts. At the beginning, we set these up and we got etcd running to make sure that they're a cluster that could talk to each other.
Right.
And now we're using etcd and a tool called Flannel that's part of CoreOS to get them up on the network, to get these hosts up on the network and get us ready to put a containerized application up on there, right?
That's correct. And now at this point, I have both my hosts on the Flannel network. If I wanted to, I'm not going to do it right now just for considerations of time and complexity, but I could ping back and forth between those hosts. I could run containers and ping back and forth. I actually am going to show you some networking configuration really quick. So if I go in and now run, we saw earlier when I ran this BusyBox container, I got an IP from that 172 subnet. But now, if I look at my IP configuration, we see I've got a Flannel IP in there. And same thing on the other host. And we'll do a quick comparison of those two. Now, see, this one's using 10.2.2. This one's using 10.2.43. So what I can do, just to demonstrate that things are actually working, one thing I can show you is there's a routing table inside the container. And so the routing table says everything going to this subnet goes to this interface, but the default gateway is our 10.2.43.1, which on the host side outside the container is our Docker bridge. If we look at the IP configuration back up here. So yeah, Docker 0, 10.2.43.1. That serves as the gateway for outgoing traffic from inside the container. Now what I can do to show that we can pass traffic back and forth, I told you before that one of the things BusyBox includes is netcat. And this is just a very simple netcat command. It just sits there and listens on a port. And so over here, I can go NC 10.2.2.2, and that port number. Now it's connected, and I can say, hello world. And I see that that was actually successfully transmitted over here. So just a very quick demo to show that, yes, it does work.
So you're inside a container, you're getting out to the network, right?
And getting across that host boundary to a container on another host, and doing it without having to set up any complicated forwarding or tunneling. Or in fact, any routing myself. Flannel handles setting up all the routing inside and outside of the container. So now we get down to the real meat of the thing. Let's actually set up our distributed application. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to set up some variables on each host just to make this a little easier to follow. And so what I've done is I set a variable to point at the local etcd proxy. I set a variable that points at the IP of the Docker bridge. And so I echoed that back out just so we can see that that's what it came out.
Sorry to interrupt. Just so people can keep up, if you're on the if you're on the instructions on GitHub, this is at the beginning of exercise 5, and there's three commands there in the first block that you have to run on each of your hosts. Easiest is just to copy and paste them in.
Yeah. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is, because I need a password, a root password for the MySQL database I'm going to set up, I'm just going to go ahead and generate one. And now, having generated one, I'm going to set that same variable on my other host.
So what you're doing here, we're going to imagine you're a blogger. Mm-hmm. You're setting up your first WordPress blog, right?
Right.
And so right now you're configuring the database and you're using MySQL. Right. You're running it inside the container. You could use anything to do that, right? You just happen to be using and setting up a scratch instance of MySQL inside the container.
Right.
Got it.
Exactly. So one of the things that we're going to use here is it's called SkyDNS. And what it is, it's actually a DNS listener that reads host names and other host data out of etcd. So we're going to use that to set a host name that our other host can use to contact the MySQL container. And the reason that's useful is because that way I don't have to worry about, oh, what was the IP of my MySQL container? I can set a host name in a programmatic, automated way, and then my WordPress configuration just uses that host name instead of having to worry about IP address changes or anything like that. So I set my random password. The first step of setting up SkyDNS, just as it is with Flannel, is to set up some configuration. I'm declaring over here a domain called whiteglove.lab. You can declare any domain you want, just as long as you remember to use that domain for the rest of it. And now I set this key here, lab whiteglove. Does that look familiar? It should look familiar. It's just the reversed components of the domain name. And then after that, the host name that I want to set. And I accidentally copied and pasted some IP. I can correct that now and just say, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the reason I just pick a random IP is because I'm not actually going to use this host name. I only set this so that on the other host I can test whether SkyDNS is working once I get it set up. The actual running of SkyDNS goes like this.
What's SkyDNS, Joe?
It is a DNS listener that pulls data out of etcd to serve host names. For any name that you want to set up in SkyDNS, you set the key for it in etcd, and then you set the host data that you want to serve inside the key. So in this case, I've only set an IP, so it's just going to serve out what's called an A record, a host record, for this name, test.whiteglove.lab, and it will give me back that IP, and that's how I'll know that SkyDNS is working. You can do other things with it. One of the things people do with SkyDNS is they set up what are called service records for, real application discovery. Since we're doing this in a very fast, restricted lab environment, we're not going to go super fancy like that. So now, having set up SkyDNS, I should be able to do this. And we see I queried it on the Docker Bridge IP because up here when I ran it with host networking, and I told it through this environment variable SkyDNS address to bind to the Docker Bridge IP. I also told it to use etcd through the etcd proxy variable that I already set up earlier. So I can now put a DNS query on my Docker Bridge IP and get back these SkyDNS responses, and we see test.whiteglove.lab 2345, exactly what I set. Now, we want to run the WordPress database. So it's now running. We got our big ugly container ID.
So it's running on one of your hosts.
It's running on host zero now. Now what I can do to set that host name, I don't have to manually do this. I can have a script, as I do here, that Docker inspects that container, pulls out the IP address. This is where JQ is super handy, because what you get back from Docker inspect is a big blob of JSON. This JQ command parses through that big blob of JSON and pulls out the IP address that's inside that container. And we see here that it did successfully pull it out. And this etcd control command sets a host name, wordpress-db.whiteglove.lab, with that flannel IP that was just pulled out. And so now, if I query for that, I will see that I get that response back. So now that's on one host. But the nice thing about SkyDNS is you can run it on multiple hosts and point it to the same etcd store and get the same responses back. So now here I didn't pull down SkyDNS, but it's pretty small. So now if I query that same host name, now note I didn't set this up on this host, but because it's talking to the same etcd cluster, I get the same response from SkyDNS. So we've got all the pieces in place, and
now you're ready to start your blog?
Now we're ready to start our blog. So we're going to actually run the WordPress container. And again, we're running, I want to call out a couple things. We're using for DNS the Docker Bridge IP because we have SkyDNS running bound to that. So the container, when it does DNS queries, will ask SkyDNS for the answer to those queries. We're giving it an environment variable to tell it what the database host is. And this response actually comes out of SkyDNS. We're also giving it a database password. Remember, we set that random password before. This is where it gets used because it needs to be able to log into the database so it can set itself up. So we run that, and it is now running. It didn't take very long because I had previously pulled that. And I'm going to, just for my own usage, get that IP. That's the WordPress flannel IP. It's reusing the IP we saw before in the BusyBox container because that's not running anymore. And now, in a real production environment, you would probably have some kind of a NAT gateway or a proxy or some kind of load balancer that would handle allowing external traffic to contact, you know, to transit into this container. In this case, I'm just going to do it via a good old SSH tunnel, and I'm going to tunnel my local port 8080 to, on the other end, it's going to go into this container. Port 80, login as core at, and let me scroll all the way back up and get my public IP here. 104.226.9. Okay. Oh, you know what? I think...
While you're doing that, I might take one of the questions we have while you're
okay. That's great.
Figuring out your login credentials.
Yeah.
So we have one about Docker and Rocket. You're using Docker commands here a lot. Whoever asked this question, I think, knows that CoreOS, our company, we also make our own container runtime called Rocket. And the question is, how come we're using Docker when we have Rocket? And I think we built Rocket because we thought there were some changes to the architecture that could make it sort of fundamentally more secure. But CoreOS Linux and our stack, including Tectonic, it's still the best place to run Docker. Mm-hmm. What Docker has done really beautifully is they have great developer tooling on Windows, on Mac, on Linux to build and your containers and manage the developer workflow. Mm-hmm. And so you're welcome to use Docker to build your stuff or to use Rocket. You're welcome to run it as Docker or as Rocket. These things interoperate. Again, we believe there's some security advantages we can do with Rocket that you can't with Docker. Docker is a great project and obviously hugely popular, and our stuff works very well with it.
And part of the reason that I'm using Docker pretty much exclusively in this specific demo is, if any of you are familiar with containers, it's much better than even odds that Docker is the container runtime you're familiar with.
Yep.
And so for the majority of you, I don't want you to be in a situation where you're going, I'm having a problem with this. Am I having a problem with this because of something wrong on my host, or because I don't understand Rocket, or you know, right, whatever the case may be. Like, keep it as familiar as I can. Okay, so now I'm logged in successfully. I should have my tunnel, which means when I go to my localhost 8080 in my web browser, what do I see? WordPress setup.
Better start your blog.
Yeah,
cool.
So now I'm going to start my blog.
Oh, you're going to write it.
The white glove has, well, I'm not actually going to write a blog post, but I am going to do the initial setup. Username, call it Jay Thompson. I don't like that password. That's not nearly strong enough for me. I'm going to use my ultra secure password because clearly that's a much better password. My email, joe.thompson@coreos.com.
And we're doing this just to show that
right,
stuff's working, stuff's getting the database, communicating
right,
between containers, et cetera.
And we'll actually see that in a second. We'll actually, to end this or to kind of tail this off, we'll log into the database in the container and see what's going on in the database. So my ultra secure password. Okay, so here's my dashboard. WordPress is up, it's operating. I can start doing stuff now. Now, if I go back for one last quickie look, I can go back to my initial host that the database is running on. And out of that MySQL container that's already running, I can exec this MySQL client and log in. Now, obviously, in real life, you would never put the root password on the command line, but again, we're in a lab, so just for simplification. Now, what I can do is show databases, and the important thing is this is just logging in as MySQL. There's nothing fancy about this because it's containerized. It's the same client and the same database that you've always used. Show tables. Is it from WordPress? And we see I have a whole bunch of tables there. Success. We started up a front end and it communicated across the network to a container running on a completely different host using our overlay. And one of the things I like to draw attention to is we did this pretty fast. I mean, I don't know how many of you were around, you know, 10, 15 years ago, but there was a time when setting up WordPress from a freshly installed host was a matter of at least a couple hours. And here we set up WordPress, if you ignore all the foregoing stuff where we were just kind of, you know, messing around with etcd, messing around with Flannel, if you just did setting up Flannel, setting up WordPress DB, setting up a WordPress front end process. And it's almost, you know, it's because these containers allow us to compose application, these layers underneath the containers that let them run with overlay networking or with service discovery, kind of make it easy to connect those composable units together. It's kind of like Tinker Toys, which may be dating myself, but you know, if you can imagine basically taking your application components, your databases and your front ends, and literally just plugging them together like Tinker Toys, and at the end of the day, you have a whole app that you built without really doing a whole lot of development per se. So it's great if you want to get up a proof of concept or package your production app in some kind of repeatable way that's easy to automate. You can automate away and containerize away a lot of that configuration that you used to have to do.
We've actually had a question about sort of simplicity here, and the question says, you did WordPress, that's nice, but is CoreOS and our containers only good for greenfield things or new applications, or can I run gnarly legacy apps there? And I'll do the high level, and then you can correct me where I go wrong. So we showed a simple app because it's simple and we had a limited amount of time here. But no, you can run anything that runs on Linux inside these containers. Actually, one thing we advise a lot of our customers who are just getting started with this is take your gnarliest, most complex legacy app, mm-hmm. package it up in a container, and get it running that way. And you will get operational benefits, you'll get maintenance benefits, you'll get simplicity and utilization benefits from doing that. And so this isn't just for blogs and for new greenfield stuff. This mm-hmm. is for some of the, you can start with some of your hardest, your hardest, most complex applications, and some of our customers have done just that.
And one of the things that I did just recently, and I need to go back and dig it out and probably update it because I think there's been a new release of this, just to get started with Rocket myself, the thing I did was I said, okay, I want to pick something that's simple but not too simple, so I containerized the Ratbox IRC daemon. So if you're not familiar with IRC, it's basically a chat server. And so what I did was I containerized that chat server, and it turned out to be very unfriendly in a lot of ways. It doesn't easily statically compile. It has a lot of very specific dependencies on things in the file system that are hard-coded. But it was actually possible to containerize it because the container runtime and the container build system lets you work around those limitations. You may find something that you're doing and you go, well, this would be easier if, you know, Rocket supported or Docker supported this particular feature that I wish I had. And the nice thing about all these runtimes being open source is you can then file an issue on GitHub, right. and somebody will pick it up and say, you know, if it's us, one of our Rocket team will pick it up and go, right. yeah, that's awesome. We should do that.
And one thing about this space in general, in order to get sort of all the benefits that we talked about at the beginning, if you want to pull the deck back mm-hmm. up, probably we're ready to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
If you want to get all the benefits we talked about at the beginning of better utilization common operating model and saving money and portability between environments, you need to be pretty buzzword compliant to really get the benefit of that. You need to be doing cloud, and you need to be doing microservices or something that looks like it. And you need to be doing DevOps. There's a bunch of people and process challenges that are just as hard as the technology challenges. When Joe talks about it's hard to put that chat app in, or I'm saying our customers are taking their biggest legacy applications, you're not going to, that big complex application is still going to be big and complex. But if you put it in the containers, you do get some of the benefit of this tooling. You do get some of the benefit of isolating the dependencies that those crazy old applications may have, maybe an old version of Python or an old version of Java or whatever it is,
right.
from the rest of your environment so other teams can work on new stuff. And it's a good way to contain what that complex old application needs so that that's not weighing you and the rest of your team down as you go forward.
Right.
So I think unless there's any other questions at the last minute, let me go back one more.
Okay.
I think we're going to move towards wrapping up, and I'm just going to go through a little bit of what you can do now, and we'll share contact information if you have a question. Looks like we do have a question. Okay, question for this one's for you, Joe. What would you do differently to roll out such a WordPress app into a production environment?
Well, like I said, you're first thing is you're going to have some kind of actual production quality, what people call an ingress now when you're talking about it in a Kubernetes platform context. And so instead of doing an SSH port forward like I did, you would actually have a device or a host that would accept that traffic on an external facing IP and would then pass it into the Flannel network because it itself would be a member of the Flannel network.
So load balancer.
It could be if you only have one instance, there's really nothing to load balance. But the idea there is just some kind of a host that is listening on both sides and can pass that traffic through. The other thing is you probably would not run these containers manually the way I ran them. You're going to run them in some kind of orchestration system that's going to do things like health monitoring. So if that WordPress front end goes down, something should be watching it and make it come back up again. Now, you can do that kind of with systemd units. You can actually have them restart if a unit fails. But what you really want is to be using some kind of orchestration system because that way you can get a higher level view and better service discovery than plugging it all together manually the way that I did. And so that's one of the things that we're going to talk about in the wrap-up is, okay, this is how you would do it manually, but it's not super resilient to do it this way. What's the real right way to do that?
Got it. So you do something for ingress, and mm-hmm. you would do something for scheduling and orchestration.
Right.
One other question. In production, if I needed to isolate a pod of containers from another pod, how would I go about that?
By default, pods run in their own contexts. So if you're running in Kubernetes, every pod has its own context, its own namespace. Unless you actually plug them together, they don't actually have any way to kind of stomp on each other. They don't see each other's view of the file system. They don't see each other's network interfaces. They're all in their own what's called a namespace. And namespaces are a feature of the Linux kernel. And there's also what's called cgroups, which are kind of process resource restrictions that they will that you can set quotas and limits on your containers and make sure that they don't stomp on each other just by consuming the host resources.
Okay. Thanks. So again, if there's other questions before we wrap here, please put them in the Q&A. Okay, I think we'll move towards wrapping. So all right, so just again recapping what we did. We provisioned a cluster of a CoreOS cluster from the Azure Marketplace. We got etcd and Flannel up and running, a little bit of manual configuration there, and we got our WordPress app up and running and looked front end at the user interface and back end at the database and made sure that was running as a very simple distributed system on there. And so again, using the iPhone analogy, it's like we booted the phone and the WordPress app is like we sort of cobbled together a dialer. That's not the iPhone that you spent $700 on or $900 on or whatever they cost. And so in order to get the full benefit of this stuff, what are some next steps? So here's a couple we recommend. One is you're going to need a scheduler. If you're running WordPress and whatever, two containers or whatever it was, you don't need a tool to schedule which jobs run where. But if you're running your production website, if you're running a big data job, if you're running something complex, there are tools that exist that have a huge amount of value to help you to automate what happens when a machine goes down. What happens if we get overloaded? How do we automatically schedule more work there? Let you get some of the resilience and self-healing benefits there. So you need a scheduler. You need an orchestrator. And so you should go and check out Tectonic, tectonic.com, which is our commercial product that bundles all this together. Or if you're interested in the open source side, you should check out Kubernetes at kubernetes.io. Which is now run by the Cloud Native Computing Foundation as an open source project of which we are huge contributors. So I think the most, if we had another couple hours to hang out with you guys, we would go through Kubernetes and how you get some of the automatic benefits of that. We also think there's interesting stuff in Rocket. We mentioned that there. A lot of you are concerned about security. You're concerned about the you're concerned about the changes in security as you move from a VM world or a bare metal world into a container world. And so Rocket has some architectural things in it that we believe make it more secure. Check that out. On the networking side, also networking is massively complicated. There's a new project that you should check out on GitHub called Canal. It's a joint effort between our company and another company called Tigera. That expands on some of the functionality that Joe showed, but brings in sort of distributed firewall and policies and a number of other things you're going to want to sort of productionize and secure your applications. And the other thing you can do is you can talk to us. If you want to talk to us on the commercial side, sales@CoreOS. If you want to talk to us on the open source side, you can email us or our team lives in IRC in the CoreOS channel on Freenode. We're happy to support you guys as you're getting up and started on this through whatever channel that may be. And with that, I think we're gonna wrap it up. So again, I'm Jeff. Contact information is there. Jeff at CoreOS. Joe actually knows what he's talking about. Thanks, Joe, for taking us through that stuff. And with that, I think we'll wrap here. And Rob, I'll hand it off to you for some quick logistics and close. And thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you for attending today's event, and a special thank you to both of our presenters. This concludes today's session. You may now disconnect.